Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's not enough just to change the constitution. It's not enough just to remove Islam from the constitution and to normalize with Israel and to reintroduce the riba-based banking system. There is an attempt now by UAE and Washington to rebuild the Sudanese state in their image.
How does America get away with this?
Bin Zayed believes that they should not be allowed to choose their rulers themselves. Allah can tolerate kufr with justice, but will not tolerate Islam with injustice.
Why is the UAE so hell-bent on working against the ummatic vision of this ummah?
Burhan lives about two blocks down from... I'm speaking American now. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah.
At a time where our attention is fixed on Gaza, rightly, another conflict is taking place with horrendous cost to human life. Sadly, as always, our ummah has been subject to the political ambitions of egotistical actors and their outside backers. Sudan is burning. There are 8 million people on the move, escaping the indiscriminate murder, rape and pillage of what can only be described as two warlords that have thwarted a people's revolution, aided by external powers. So we've had our chocolate break, Sammy. Let's talk about Sudan, another really important issue, I think, that's impacting this ummah, and probably an area where I would, you know, suggest myself as well. We haven't really been following quite intimately, and I know you have. So it's probably worth starting from the very beginning. So it's suggested that maybe over 10,000 people have been killed in the year crisis that has beset Sudan. I suspect that's a low figure, and there's probably much more. There's around 8 million people who are internal or external refugees who've either fled the country or are moving around the country. There is a contest between two army men, General Burhan and General Hemeti. Tell us a bit about these two individuals, the current crisis, before we work our way backwards and look at some of the longer term issues that has led to where we are today.
I think that in Sudan, to put it in very simple terms, the aim of the war in Sudan that is led by Hemeti, backed by the UAE and with which Washington enjoys great sympathy for, is a bid to reconstruct the army in Sudan in order to impose ideological changes to the state. By ideological changes to state, what I mean is removing Islam from the constitution, normalizing ties with Israel, re-establishing the riba system, the interest-based economic system in Sudan itself, and to make Sudan much more pliant than it's been in the past. And Hemeti is now fighting a war by proxy on behalf of the UAE and Washington in order to try to reconstruct the Sudanese army. That's in simple terms. The outbreak of the war began when Burhan, the general who, the head of the Supreme Council who was ruling Sudan, realized that the leftist parties who were part of this transition period were frustrated that they were not being given power by the army or by the military or the like to rule as they wished over an extended transition period, and therefore they had hoped that Hemeti would be able to topple Burhan and then hand over power to them. The reason being is that in 2019, after the revolution, if you want to call it that, there was a concern in UAE and in Washington that if elections were held in Sudan, then the Sudanese would not vote for leftist parties or parties of an ideological leaning that was preferable to Washington or the UAE, but rather they would still vote for Muslim-leaning parties. If they didn't vote for the Islamist Omar Bashir, they would vote for Islamists of a different party or the like, but that there would still be a very Muslim identity to the Sudanese state. And as a result, there was an agreement with leftist parties and the Communist Party under the banner of Qiwa al-Hurriya wa Taghyir, which is the Forces for Freedom and Change, they call themselves, in which they agreed on a transition period whereby they would be able to conduct constitutional changes of the state without needing to go back to the people. And the reason being, it's important to highlight that Sudan has been under sanction for 30 years, specifically to bring about those ideological changes and to remove the Muslim nature of the state. When you talk about 2019 revolution, there's often a desire to look at it within the context of the Arab Spring. But Sudan is very different from the Arab Spring. Sudan in 2019 was seen as the result of the 30 years of sanctions, which is why when Omar Bashir's government was toppled, the Sudanese people felt they did a revolution, but Washington believed wholeheartedly that Bashir had been toppled as a result of sanctions, that they had squeezed the economy enough to finally force people out onto the streets to topple al-Bashir, and therefore Washington would dictate the terms, not the Sudanese. That it would be Washington who dictate the terms, not the Sudanese, in the way perhaps that the Tunisians had dictated their own transition in Tunisia itself, which is why that the Sudanese were stunned that even after toppling al-Bashir, they could not dictate the terms of the transition agreement.
Why could they not dictate the terms?
The reason they could not dictate the terms was that, in essence, when the Burhan and Hamiti, they toppled Omar al-Bashir. So the story goes that there's a province called Gadharif. Gadharif, the governor, lifted subsidies on oil, on the petrol. So for context, Sudan had the cheapest petrol of all of the Arab world, cheaper even than Saudi Arabia, because it was heavily subsidized. Because as a result of the sanctions, the Bashir government sought to increasingly subsidize the oil to make things easier for the Sudanese people. As a result of the economic squeezing, there was an economic crisis in 2017 whereby there wasn't enough cash in the economic system. So there was money in the banks, but there wasn't enough cash going around. So you'd go to a cash machine and the cash machine would not have enough cash to give you the money that you have in your account itself. So there was a number of economic reforms that were sought to be implemented by the Bashir government. In Gadharif, one of the provinces, they lifted the subsidies on petrol. But even when they lifted the subsidies, it wasn't like a hike in the way, for example, you know, it suddenly became more expensive than Saudi Arabia. It went from like one guinea, or like one Sudanese pound, to about five Sudanese pound. And then there was also lifting the subsidies on bread. And that resulted in an outbreak of protest that took place, and the protest took place in Khartoum itself. When the protest took place in Khartoum, it was unclear what everybody should do. So Omar al-Bashir invites Hamiti of the Rapid Support Forces. The Rapid Support Forces was a force that was set up by Omar al-Bashir to guard the border with Chad and Libya, because Chad and Libya were seen as the supply chains for the Darfur rebels when they would revolt against Khartoum. So he established the RSF in order to keep that border there. He invited Hamiti to provide extra support to try to keep the protests in Khartoum under control. Salah Ghosh, the head of intelligence, Hamiti and Burhan, who was a general in the army, they eventually decided to topple Omar al-Bashir and to seize power for themselves. When they seized power for themselves, they realized very quickly that none of them had the ability to really change anything in Sudan without the support of Washington lifting the restrictions on finances to Sudan itself. And unless Washington would finance Sudan, none of the other nations would come and finance Sudan itself. The Qataris were not willing to put finances in, neither were the UAE, neither were Saudi Arabia, because they wanted to see changes first take place to the state, as with Washington itself. So the Washington believed that given that it was the one that would dictate the terms, they laid out the terms that were necessary. And that's why when they formed the transition government, in the beginning, Burhan and Hamiti, the generals who had toppled al-Bashir, when they entered negotiations with the leftist parties made a series of demands. Amongst the demands were 69% appointed members of parliament. Not elected, appointed. They all agreed there should not be elections. So they agreed 69% appointed members of parliament, a constitutional committee that would be run by them to allow them to make changes to the constitution. And when they started falling out over how to share the power, the UAE came in and broke in an agreement and reminded them that, guys, if you don't agree, elections might actually be held and elections will ruin all of us. If we let the Sudanese choose, they will not choose you, the leftist parties. You guys won't even get 2-3%. And the generals will be ousted from power as well, because the army elements are already angry that you guys did a coup on and you guys took the leadership for yourself. So they decided to agree in this very awkward transition agreement whereby there would be a Supreme Council. The army would technically rule for 2 years. So al-Bashir would, so Burhan would rule for 2 years, and then he'd hand over power in 2021 to the leftist parties, but there would be a civilian government. That civilian government would rule on its own. Washington was very clear about the ideological change that it wanted in Sudan, which is why very quickly Burhan made a deal with the rebel movements in the north, in which one of the terms was, we will remove Islam from the constitution. The leftist parties, the civilian government, then restored the interest-based banking system in Sudan despite popular protest. Then they normalized ties with the Israelis despite protest from the Sudanese people, things that could never be achieved democratically. When the 2 years came up in 2021, the Americans and the UAE went for their next stage, which is that given that the army remains very much Islamist and given that the army is what has resisted the pressure from Washington over the past 30 years to make those ideological changes, in order to rebuild the Sudanese state, it's not enough just to change the constitution. It's not enough just to remove Islam from the constitution and to normalize with Israel and to reintroduce the riba-based banking system. We need to remove that which upholds the Islamic identity of Sudan. I'm not saying Islamic identity in that Sudan is Islamic. I'm saying that Sudan being, that Islam being a major role in Sudan.
Political identity.
Political identity. That given the army was the one that resisted us for 30 years under the guise of Umar al-Bashir, albeit I say the army, Umar al-Bashir's final government had 23 parties, part of it as well, including the other parties and the like. We need to restructure the army. So in 2021, after those 2 years where they had embarked on that normalization of ties and removing Islam from the constitution and reintroducing the riba-based economic system and the like, and making concessions to the rebel movements, the next stage was, how do we reconstruct the army? So the UAE from 2019 had been supporting Hemeti and building his RSF, his Rapid Support Forces. So what was supposed to be an auxiliary force ended up a very powerful force. So Hemeti's forces went and fought in Yemen. They went to fight in Libya. They went to fight in other arenas. The UAE training these forces to become like a proper army. And the suggestion was that Washington would agree to the army being dismantled and that the RSF would be the new core on which the army would be built around.
Yeah.
The reason that part is important is because when the Syrians argue that the Americans want to destroy the Assad regime because it's against Israel, it's a half-truth, but there is some truth to it. And it's the same concept that they apply to Iraq, in that the Israelis identified that the Arab armies are anti-Zionist and that therefore, as part of normalizing in the region, these armies need to be dismantled and rebuilt. And that's why it was believed that there was a very quick move to punish Iraq. Even though bin Laden had come from Afghanistan to bomb the Twin Towers, it's one of the reasons why Iraq was very quickly seen as an area to attack, dismantle the army and rebuild it in a way that will provide a haven for the Israelis. And also why the US jumped on what was happening in Syria to try to encourage the dismantling of the army in Syria as well. I'm not saying the Syrian army is good or just in any way. I'm saying the American ideal of the new Middle East requires a reorganization of the army itself, which is why in Sudan they also saw it in the same aspect. Because in Sudan, what al-Bashir had done was, as a result of the sanctions, he built these huge weapons manufacturing factories and he was able to build his own weapons afterwards. And Netanyahu is on record as having said to the Americans that Sudan needs to be sanctioned. This is about 96, 97. Sudan needs to be sanctioned because the Palestinians are getting their weapons from Sudan itself. So as a result, they believe the army needed to be reconstructed and dismantled and with the RSF. In 2021, when it came to the time to hand over power to the civilian, of course, the army said, no, absolutely not, because we know what's happening. So when the leftist parties found it was very difficult to dismantle the army, that's when they asked Hemeti to go and get rid of Burhan. So there was an agreement, even with some elements of the army, that Hemeti would go and assassinate Burhan, take over power, and then dismantle the army and put the RSF as the new core, and then bring these leftist parties into power, and Washington and the UAE would together embark on these ideological changes to the state that the Americans desired and for which they imposed the 30 years of sanctions for. Burhan lives about two blocks down from, I'm speaking American now, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. In any case, two streets down. I make Toba for that. Yes. I speak English. Two streets down. Yes. Hemeti was supposed to assassinate him quickly in the night and then move on. Burhan got a tip off. I think about 30 of Burhan's guards were killed, but Burhan managed to run away. And now there is this war now between the army and between the rapid support forces backed by the UAE. The army made some gains, but then the UAE amplified its support for the RSF. And that's why you see that Washington is very timid in what it says about Sudan, because Washington also believes that the ideological changes it wants to bring to the state is unique to the RSF. Some people might say I'm exaggerating the idea of the ideological changes, but it's important to highlight some context about Sudan.
Yeah.
Sudan, after the British left, what they did was, Sudan is an amalgamation of different areas. So what the British did, they lumped these areas together. Darfur, who are non-Arab tribes, the south, which is where the Christians are, and then the Muslim Arab, you know, northerners, and that became Sudan. As a result of this amalgamation of different, there's always been fighting and chaos. The south don't want to be part of Sudan. The Darfurians believe they should have their own independent state. And there's always been conflict. And there's always been different nations supporting different factions against the Sudanese, which is why Sudan has gone through coup after coup after coup after coup after coup. In 1982, John Garang appears from the south and he leads a rebel movement in the south. The reason why I say 1982 is because 1983 is when Sharia is announced in Sudan. Is to highlight that Garang was not revolting against Sharia or against what's happening in Islam. Garang had already begun his independence movement in the south. In 1983, Nimeiri announces Sharia. He removes the riba-based banking system and he imposes a law. But 2 years later, Garang is making advances. He's taking different cities and the like. So the military does a coup in Nimeiri. Suwar al-Dhahab takes over. Suwar al-Dhahab rules for 1 year, then hands over to elections. Sadiq al-Mahdi comes to power. Sadiq al-Mahdi rules for 3 years. But in those 3 years, John Garang in the south, backed by the Americans, has now taken multiple cities and he's besieging Juba, the capital of the south. The army say, listen, this is outrageous. So Sadiq al-Mahdi, you do something or we're going to topple you. The Ba'athists, the Arab nationalists, are planning a coup. The Islamists realize the Ba'athists are going to do the coup on Thursday. They go and do the coup on Wednesday. And they go and take power. Throughout that period, the Americans are insistent, and the Christian organizations of America are insistent, Sudan needs to be split. It needs to have that south needs to be split, and Darfur also needs to be split. So Darfur receives support. You'll remember throughout the 90s, it was like Darfur, what's happening in Darfur. And the South Sudan eventually, in 2005, it secedes from Sudan itself. Bashir eventually turns around and says, listen, we were never technically united anyway. Khalas, just get off my back. The Darfurians are supported by the Americans so much so that they get to Umm Durman in 2008. Umm Durman is in Khartoum, like it's on the outskirts, not outskirts, but just inside Khartoum. They enter Khartoum itself. The reason why I'm mentioning all of this point is that the pressure that was brought on Sudan was wholeheartedly in order to achieve ideological changes. What we're seeing now in Sudan is a bid by the UAE and Washington to finally deliver on the reasons for which those sanctions were imposed in the first place, which is to eliminate the Muslim identity of Sudan and completely reorient its identity in a way that is conducive to allowing the Israelis to be integrated into the region again, because it was from Sudan that the three no's were announced. No to normalization, no to occupation, no. It was from Sudan that it was announced, which is why Sudan, when it normalized, the Israelis really celebrated the victory. They said this was the land of the three no's, now it's the land of the three yeses in terms of normalization or the like. This is not to say that Burhan is defending Islam. Not at all. Yeah. There are intricacies to the dynamics that we can talk about afterwards. Burhan is not defending Islam, but rather what's happening in Sudan is the people are out of the dynamics completely. Because for Washington, it was never a popular revolution that toppled al-Bashir. For the UAE, it was never a popular revolution that toppled al-Bashir. Have you ever seen the UAE and Saudi celebrate a revolution? Have you ever seen the Saudi ambassador celebrate their support? No, because in their perspective, it wasn't a revolution. From their perspective, Sudan was sanctions imposed al-Bashir, a new generation that grew up under sanctions, that saw on Instagram what the world looks like outside of Sudan and said, we desire more. And instead of blaming the sanctions, they blamed Omar al-Bashir. This is not me defending Omar al-Bashir, but it's to highlight some information about how Omar al-Bashir was able to survive those sanctions. Sudan in 1989 had three universities. Today it has 100. Sudan in 1989 had one bridge to cross the Nile. It now has more than eight across different parts of the Nile to cross. Sudan used to have maybe 100 health centers. It now has more than 600. Sudan, in other words, despite those sanctions, Sudan was able to develop and was able to develop that particular infrastructure. Bashir was able to survive those sanctions up to a point where the Americans were finally beginning to talk about lifting those sanctions and actually... At that moment is when the people decided to take to the streets to protest after the lifting of the subsidies, and now the country has been plunged into war. Where the fuel went from one guinea, one dinar to five, now it's about 600, 700 guinea for the petrol. It was once cheaper than Saudi Arabia, now it's through the roof expensive. The point is that it shows you how the Bashir government and with those 23 alliance parties that were with him, that included parties from Darfur, were able to navigate those particular sanctions. But going back to the original point, many people will say that this is a war between two warlords, as you did in your introduction. That's true on a superficial level. But at the heart of it, the reason why there is war in Sudan is because there is an attempt now by UAE and Washington to rebuild the Sudanese state in their image. And that image is one in which there is no Islam. And that's why the army is resisting the dismantling, not necessarily maybe perhaps it wants to protect the state, but it knows that as soon as that army is dismantled, we enter a situation like Iraq, which enters chaos, and we also enter a situation where Washington steamrolls those ideological changes. And the interesting thing is this, that Washington is making its financing of Sudan conditional on the ideological changes, which is why you have none of the parties talking about elections. the Hemeti and the leftist civilian parties that they talk about, led by Hamdouk, who was their prime minister, the civilian parties are adamantly against elections because they know the Sudanese tendencies are not aligned with them. Sudanese people, of course, rightly lambast the al-Bashir government over the past 30 years, that it didn't produce what it was supposed to produce. That's 100% true. The point I'm making here is not that al-Bashir was good or the like. The point I'm making here is that while the Sudanese people are trying to push for their freedom and agency to choose their own rulers, Washington and the UAE believe them to be outside the dynamics because there are ideological goals that they are seeking to achieve. And this is why, despite the genocide that Hemeti is committing in Darfur, the Americans, who were the loudest in support of Darfur during the 1990s and 2000s, are silent about what's happening in Darfur because they believe that the genocide, they're willing to turn a blind eye to it if it means that Hemeti can be allowed to dismantle this army that refuses to impose the ideological changes that Washington is after.
So I've got two questions. Let's start with question one, the American motive. So the American motive, your argument is it's ideological and it's trying to subvert not just the popular revolution, democracy in Sudan, but also subvert the Islamic character of the state. And that seems to be where you're going here. Is Hemeti is the vehicle to do that in order to erode the power structures within the army and replace it with a far more secular leftist movement. So that seems pretty clear. I suppose the question really is, how does America get away with this? I mean, from a superficial perspective, you know, the Americans talk a lot about human rights and they talk about democracy. And of course, Biden in particular, you know, he's the guy who convened two or three democracy conferences around the world. And, you know, he's on record talking about how his administration is a bulwark against Russian and Chinese authoritarianism. This may be a very simplistic question in many ways, but how does the American administration get away with so obviously backing a force that is trying to thwart that groundswell civilian movement?
Put yourself in the Zionist position. The Zionists, in the history of the creation of the Israeli state, were invaded by Arab nations when they first announced their state.
Yeah.
And then they had the Six-Day War. And then they had the war over Sinai that took place as well. Mm. The Zionists believe that the armies of the Arab nations are anti-Zionist and that are committed to the destruction of Israel because they believe, rightly so, that Israel stole the land of the Palestinians and it's colonizing the Palestinian lands. The conclusion of the Zionists after those wars was that the armies need to be dismantled. The Arab armies need to be restructured. They need to be dismantled. The reason I say this is that Biden pursues it from the framework of peace, that to achieve peace in the region, these armies need to be retrained and they need to be retrained, which is why America spends a lot on the armies in terms of providing them military aid and the like, to retrain the armies into a way that lets them abandon those anti-Zionist tendencies in order to try to come up with a new army that is more amenable to integration. Why? Because these countries are not democracies. Yeah. These countries are ruled by military rule. And therefore, if we can make sure the military are pro-Zionist, then therefore Israel will be able to be successfully integrated into the state. And as Robert Kennedy suggested, Israel is the U.S. outpost through which the U.S. is able to maintain a foothold in that jungle that is the Middle East. His words, not mine. The point being is that Biden justifies it from the idea of peace. That at the end of the day, Omar Bashir ruled for 30 years and it was considered a military dictatorship. Biden argues. I always say that Sudan sometimes is a bit more nuanced. Al-Bashir was able to bring in many parties into his government. I'm not saying he was ideal or perfect. I'm not saying there were free and fair elections. I'm saying that there was at least consensus governments on multiple occasions, to the extent that even Jibril Ibrahim from Darfur, a non-Arab who is now finance minister under this new government, Jibril Ibrahim, who was leading the forces that reached Omdurman in 2008, he led the forces from Darfur, almost took the capital Khartoum. Jibril Ibrahim himself entered into a government, him and Minim Minnawi and all these other people, they entered the government of Omar Bashir afterwards, and they were able to establish a peace agreement with al-Bashir and enter his government and also to rule with al-Bashir itself. The point is that the US argues that in order to achieve peace, we need to restructure these armies. And while the process may be difficult and turbulent, it is a very necessary process in order to do so. And that's why, while he convenes these structures of democracy, Biden's definition of democracy is one in which much more leftist, anti-religion, one in which Islam does not dominate. And we saw that even in the Arab Spring, in that when the Islamists, they won, and I'm not saying the Islamists were the ideal representation of what Muslim politics looks like, but certainly when the people demonstrated an affinity for Muslim-leaning parties,
Tunisia, Egypt.
In the words of Macron in 2020 in the Le Grand Continent magazine, he said that when the Arab Spring elections took place, we realized the Arab populations have an affinity for regression. In other words, that they voted wrongly, basically. It shows that the Americans believe that in their democracy, there's no room for the Islamists. There's no room for these religious leaning parties. And therefore, in their perspective, to pursue this democracy in Sudan, if that's what they're pursuing in Sudan, to pursue this democracy in Sudan requires these ideological changes to the state. But I think that in Sudan, more specifically, it's more to do with how do you integrate Israel into the region. The Iraqi army is now destroyed.
Yeah.
Assad is now out of, the Syrian army is now out of action as a result of Assad. I'm not saying it's as a result of Assad. You look at the Saudi Crown Prince, Vision 2030, moving away from all that. The Egyptian army is placid. It's not doing anything in terms of... And now you have the Sudan as well, where you have the ability now to reconstruct the army itself through Hamiti, who's supported by the UAE itself. So it's not about whether the US justifies it or not. It's that the US has very carefully constructed a sanctions campaign that had lasted for 30 years that is now bearing fruit from its perspective. And now it's trying to allow room through which it believes this turbulent process would lead to a transition period whereby they can socially engineer Sudanese society to abandon the role of Islam in politics and social life and accept a new form of secular civil rule that will help to contribute to the integration of Israel into the region in a way that the Sudanese were adamantly against before, to the extent that al-Bashir in 2019 even refused to allow an Israeli plane to cross over Sudanese airspace to go towards Kenya itself.
Let's talk about the UAE, because there seems to be a common theme here when we talk about the Muslim world, and we've highlighted the nefarious role of Saudi Arabia in the region and Iran in the region. Maybe we don't give enough time to discuss in the UAE. I mean, it seems that the UAE is far more purposeful than, say, Saudi Arabia, and far more strategic in a nefarious and horrible way than the Saudis are. I'm not sure if you agree or disagree with that, but why is the UAE so hell-bent on working against, if we were to call it the Ummatic approach to this ummah, or vision of this ummah? Why are they so hell-bent on destroying any form of Islamic movements in the Muslim world?
I think there is the short answer and there is a complex answer. I think for the UAE, I think the Arab Spring was a huge wake-up call. I think the UAE was stunned that the Arab Spring has spread so fast, that the people demonstrated they had agency, that authoritarianism was unable to subdue the people, and that the people still had an affinity for some sort of Islamic rule, and that this wave was spreading super fast and had the potential to topple the monarchies. And therefore, there is a need now to re-educate the Muslim populations. There is a need now to demonstrate that what the people want is not freedom and dignity. What they want is economic prosperity. And I can produce that in a name other than Islam. In the New York Times article, the dark vision of the Middle East prince or something, or vision, the dark prince of the Middle East. In any case, he says that it's said in it that Bin Zayed tells Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, and says to him that these are a people, he tells him in 2013, he tells him this, the article's in 2020, but he tells him in 2013, he says, these are a people who believe that a 1400-year-old book should be a constitution. Are these the kind of people you want to choose their leaders? And it resonates deeply. I think Macron's statement that the people chose regressively, I think it's a statement he heard as opposed to a statement that he came up with himself through his communication, close ties with the UAE itself. I think that in the context of Sudan itself, I think that its involvement in Sudan has more to do with being proactive instead of reactive. No, they reacted to the Arab Spring. They're now being proactive in Sudan in terms of constructing what's happening. And the reason why I say it is that Sudanese themselves, in terms of internal dynamics, were actually able to come to some sort of agreements and negotiations between themselves. John Garang, who led the South Sudan rebellion, in 2005, he agreed to be the vice president of Omar al-Bashir as part of the peace agreements. In other words, they were able to come together and agree. Jibril Ibrahim entered, after leading the revolt against Khartoum, entered al-Bashir's government afterwards. They held the peace agreement together and they agreed with each other and they established a semi-autonomous region. Al-Bashir had a knack for coming up with these agreements in between. And I think that the Sudanese sensitivity to foreign intervention was clear when the Saudi ambassador, after the toppling of al-Bashir, said, but for Saudi Arabia, al-Bashir would not have been toppled. And he got a backlash from the Saudis, from the Sudanese people. Yasser Arman, one of the prominent, you know, leftist communist rebels, who armed rebels, he was lambasted by Sudanese. They said, you know, you keep talking about, you know, why are we allowing the UAE to interfere? And he said, there's nothing wrong with seeking foreign help to defeat the Islamists and to remove these Islamic influences from politics. He doesn't dare say to remove Islam from Sudan, but to remove the Islamic influences from politics itself. I think the UAE is trying to be proactive primarily because Sudan is a large country with a large coast on the Red Sea. the UAE believes that now is the time to be proactive in order to ensure that the population is re-educated in a way that ensures that they do not embark on revolutions that will affect the established norm of the system. The UAE believes that Bin Ali's problem was not that he was aggressive in his human rights violations in Tunisia, but that he didn't produce a Dubai or Abu Dhabi. UAE says, look at my country. They don't have rights to talk about politics, but they go in the morning to work and they have entertainment in the evening. That's what people want. That's the vision that the UAE pushes. And that's why I think the UAE has become very proactive in this regard, because it believes that it's pushing back against an existential threat, which is a people that believe that they should choose their rulers, whereas Bin Zayed believes that they should not be allowed to choose their rulers themselves. And that's why the UAE has been the prime broker in Sudan. The Sudanese, when they came to the transition agreement, they weren't all in agreement as to who should rule. The way the UAE has been able to maintain that transition is by telling the Sudanese parties that if you fail to agree between yourselves, there will be elections and you will all lose. And they all panic and say, we don't want Sudanese to choose. We don't want Sudanese to choose. And they come together and they form a government once more. I think that the reason that the war broke out despite the UAE mediating is because when it came to the issue of dismantling the army, the UAE believed has been preparing for it for 5 years. It's been preparing it by supporting Hemeti. It's been preparing it by training his forces. There was the Wall Street Journal article which showed that the UAE was sending 30 planes a week through Uganda to the border with Chad to deliver weapons and arms to Hemeti. When Hemeti was still struggling to take Niala in the west, the UAE upped that to 50 planes a week. So it was 30 planes in August and September, then 50 planes in October and November a week going via Uganda to the border with Chad. The Chad president visited the UAE 3 times during this war. Each time the Chad president visits, Hemeti manages to gain some sort of momentum on the field. And that's why Chad was criticized publicly as being the means through which weapons are being supplied to Hemeti. And Chad has a history of facilitating the arms flow to West Sudan. Hemeti believes, or the UAE believes, that there are two potential scenarios they can achieve in Sudan. Either Hemeti topples the army in Khartoum and takes Khartoum. They took Khartoum by surprise. The army didn't see it coming, but now it seems the army, according to reports, are now retaking large sections of Khartoum. But the UAE believes that either Hemeti topples Burhan, or Hemeti can set up an alternative government in the west, in the second largest city called Niala. Niala is where Darfur is, it's where the non-Arabs are. The problem with the second plan of the UAE is that Darfur, because they are non-Arabs, Hemeti and the RSF are notorious because they're accused of being racist and committing genocide against those local populations.
He led the Janjaweed militias.
And that's why in order to impose himself in Darfur, Hemeti has had to really go...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Go and crack down on the population. There have been videos of corpses on the streets.
Some say 10,000 people just in that region alone. I don't know how true that is.
It's considered a genocide by all means.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, why aren't the Darfurian groups joining the fight against Hemeti? Because if you look at, for those who don't know, in Sudan, there are two Darfurian giants, I call them, Minni Minnawi and Jibril Ibrahim. Jibril Ibrahim is the current finance minister in the government, standing with Burhan, standing with the army. Minni Minnawi has this big army group, tribal group that he has. But Minni Minnawi announced, I'm neutral in this conflict, and didn't really enter too much. A couple of times he's gone and met Burhan, suggesting he's more amenable towards the army. And one of the concessions it's been said is that, for those who don't know the map of Sudan, you have Niala, you have the western part, but there's also a place called Fashir, which is where Minni Minnawi and these guys are really concentrated. The idea being that the UAE is trying to convince Minni Minnawi that, let Hemeti take Niala, let him control those areas, and I promise he won't come near Fashir or your sphere of influence, and you guys can stay there, and we'll bring you part as part of the negotiations that are taking place in and of themselves. The UAE believes the second scenario it can achieve is similar to the Libya scenario, where Haftar in 2019 went after Tripoli, the capital. He crossed all of Libya. He conquered the east and then marched rapidly Tarhuna, then past Tarhuna, then he entered Tripoli. He laid siege to Tripoli, and Trump said to him, look, bluntly, John Bolton said it. Might not have said it, but it was implied. I think it was Ghassan Salama, the UN envoy, gave an interview where he said the US, it's as if it gave a green light to the offensive. Haftar laid siege to Tripoli and has an opportunity to take Tripoli and seize Libya. Of course, he fails because of the Turkish intervention. But the backup plan was that if he can't take Tripoli, we split the country in two and we set up a capital in the east, which is Benghazi, where Haftar rules. Hemeti tried to take Niala two times. The first time, there's a famous video of a general who actually died in the battle, where he says, listen, we either win the battle or we die here. They managed to push back Hemeti's forces, and then the general died. But then the Hemeti later on went in again, and the rumors are, the suggestions are, he's taken Niala. The belief is that the UAE will say, if Hemeti can't take Khartoum, he will set up an alternative capital in that western area, in Niala itself. The UAE believes that Sudan, if it can't restructure the army, it can paralyze the army by splitting Sudan even further. And the reason they talk about splitting Sudan is to go back to the original point, which is the British put artificially Sudan together in this idea of Darfur and South Sudan. I remember Abd al-Rahim Hamdi, Allah yarahmu, who was the finance minister, I remember he said once in an interview, he said, people say that Sudan split between North and South, but I argue they were never united in the first place, that the South was never really with us. The point here being is, you're asking, what do the UAE want? The UAE wants to determine the trajectory that Sudan is going in to ensure that it does not produce a result similar to the Arab Spring, where you have a Muslim-leaning Orient, whereby it suddenly inspires other populations to be free, to choose their leaders, to choose Muslim-leaning parties who will influence UAE population and threaten the UAE monarchies. The UAE wants to make sure that it's able to dictate that trajectory. And it's found resonance in Washington because its message is clear. If we allow elections, Muslim party wins. Do you want that? Washington says, no. If we allow elections, the Sudanese will not choose the way you want. We need time to train them. Do you agree with me? Yes. We need an extended transition period? Yes. We need to make unilateral changes to the constitution? Yes. And Washington agrees with all of that, which is why you see Washington very loud on Ukraine, Washington very loud on Belarus, Washington very loud on these issues, but very timid when it comes to Sudan.
Exactly. I mean, that explains the situation very well. I've got one final question for you, Sami. We're approaching the 3rd of March, 100 years since the demise of the Ottoman Caliphate, notwithstanding everything that you've said. And the very fact is that by 1924, the Ottoman Caliphate was a pale, shadow of its former self. So we know that. And we know that many reforms had been undertaken by that point. But symbolically, at least, the caliphate system collapsed on the 3rd of March, 1924, and the caliph was sent into exile. And that is a moment, a tremendous moment, a momentous moment in a negative sense for the Muslim Ummah. Everything we've talked about today, indicates a Muslim world in almost near collapse. A Muslim world that is being torn apart by external forces, by Zionism, by leaders who claim to be Muslim, but who are working day and night against Islam. We know the hadith of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, where he says, innama al-imam al-junnah, that the imam is a junnah, a shield behind whom you fight and you defend yourselves. And the idea of caliphate is so intrinsic, I suppose, to Islamic history, if not Islamic text. There is a nostalgia, maybe more than a nostalgia, a cogent argument to suggest that unless you have a serious program to return back to this type of leadership, the Muslim Ummah is going to be subject to the horrid wars that ravage the Muslim world, the nefarious actors like the UAE that seek to divide and undermine our unity, and Zionism, of course, which has established its state and remains very prominent in the heart of the Muslim world. So I suppose I want you to tackle that point. How important is the caliphate to you and to your program, notwithstanding, by the way, how easy or hard? I think it's difficult. I'm not in any way undermining the program. It's a very difficult program, but as an idea, how important is it to you? And secondly, I suppose, like, set out for me the next 100 years. I know that's very difficult. Your ideal, what should the next 100 years look like? So take those in turn, inshallah.
I think that one of the things that when you read about Muslim history is that caliphates came and collapsed. Nations came and collapsed. And one of the things that I used to always think about is, why is it that you have a caliphate, you have a masjid on every street, you have Ramadan full during Taraweeh, but Allah still destroys those nations, still they collapse, whether it's Andalusia or in Baghdad or these places or the like. And then you come across readings, Ibn Khaldun, Al-Adlu Asasul Mulk, justice is the foundation of all dominion. And Ibn Taymiyyah, who says that Allah will preserve a kafir state that is just, but will destroy a Muslim state that is unjust. For Allah can tolerate kufr with justice, but will not tolerate Islam with injustice. When you read about the literature from Muslim history, you'll find that although modern literature focuses on the form of what the state looks like, the scholars of old focused on the substance of what the people were like. Because they argued that when the substance of the people was one in which they stood for justice and strove and kept moving, the form follows. And we tend to flip it on the other way. The reason why I say it is that if the form was what leads to the substance, the caliphate would not have fallen, because the caliphate would have protected that particular substance. And that's why I think that when Muhammad Asad says it's not Muslims that made Islam great, it's Islam that makes Muslims great. What he said was, and he elaborates on it, he says, when Islam becomes a manual for action, that it inspires you to action, to stand for justice, to mobilize in your entrepreneurship, in your reading, in your engagements, in your interactions, in your purpose in life, the Muslims produced extraordinary things, amongst them a caliphate, amongst them nation states, amongst them in science and the like. But when Islam became a series of rituals, focusing on the forms, focusing on the rituals, focusing habits, and that putting that as the paramount importance, that's when Allah removes the glory of the ummah and relegates them to the humiliation that many people complain about today. And that's why I feel that when it comes to the 100 years, I always look at the Muslim ummah from a different perspective, in that the Ottoman caliphate fell, like caliphates fell before it. But the reality is that the colonizing powers were unable to capitalize on it. Because when the Ottoman lost the control over North Africa, even though Ottomans no longer had control over Libya, like I gave the story of Ahmed Sanusi, he still obeyed the Sultan when he told him, go and attack the British in Egypt. The reason being is that there was still an affinity for the idea of a unified Muslim leadership. And that affinity is still actually exists today. I think that what's absent is not an affinity for a united Muslim leadership, but rather an appreciation of the individual battles that each arm of the ummah is fighting. The reason why I say it is, we were talking earlier about the travel and I was saying reconnecting the memories of the ummah. The question is always posed as if the Muslim ummah is doing nothing in order to revive or re-establish a unified leadership. I actually argue no. I agree that the philosophers who talk about it are the ones who are doing nothing of substance or practice. In reality, the ones of practice are the ones who are not talking the loudest about it. Because when you go to Bosnia, for example, and you find that the Yugoslavian communist regime tried to wipe out Islam, shut down the Muslim associations, execute half their leaders, put the rest in hard labor, try to ban the printing of the Quran. Then when the Yugoslavia falls apart, and Bosnia is established, the Serbians invade and they try to commit a genocide, and still the Muslims hold on. All they have to do is give up La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, and then they will be able to live in comfort without the persecution. Mladic said, you are our people, but we don't like the fact you have Islam and that you're Muslims. Abandon it and come back to what we were about. That's all they needed to do, but they refused to give it up. Why? Because they believed this was the way to keep the hope alive for a unified Muslim leadership. That's what Izzet Begovic spoke about in his book when he talks about what does it mean to be part of an ummah? What does it mean to be a Muslim nation? What does it mean to be? We always look, people talk about Bosnia, for example, they say, yeah, but you know, he talked about coexistence between Jews and the Christians. But when you look at the Muslim ummah caliphates, they were all about coexistence between the Christians and the Jews. That's where the Jews found their haven. Think about it. Prophet ﷺ enters Medina and gives them the Medina constitution, which says to the Jews, anyone who oppresses you, we will fight against them. Umar al-Khattab enters Jerusalem. The Romans have kicked out the Jews. Umar al-Khattab brings them back. The Crusaders take Jerusalem. They kick the Jews out. Salah ad-Din Ayyubi brings them back. Isabella kicks the Jews out to Spain. It's the Ottomans who send the ships to bring the Jews back. You look after the Holocaust. Where do they flee? They go to Palestine, to the Muslim lands, and they unfurl the banners and they say, please don't do to us what the Europeans did to us. The reason why I say all of this is, I think that it's less to do with what can we do to establish a unified Muslim leadership and more about understanding what are the other limbs of the ummah doing. I always argue that one of the greatest tragedies of colonization was not actually just the physical part. It's the mental part. It's the psychological part that tore the limbs from each other, whereby the Muslim of old could talk about the politics of Morocco all the way to Jakarta. The Muslim today can barely talk about the politics within their own border because they haven't reconnected with those memories. I always tell people that when you go to countries like Uzbekistan, Bosnia, Turkey, Malaysia, Ghana, Nigeria, You should go as a cup that is going to be filled with the memories of that ummah, where you sit with them and you suddenly discover that the ummah has never actually laid down and accepted defeat. The ummah kept pushing. The literature in Sokoto, in northern Nigeria, for example, that hardcore Muslim identity where they're very proud of it and they uphold it, and where there's still such a dominant force, or in Mali or in Senegal, now on TikTok, all these Senegal Qura are going viral in terms of upholding traditions of the Quran and the Hadith. The ummah never actually laid down and accepted it. And that's why I argue that when we talk about unified Muslim leadership, people always talk about it from the concept that the Muslims have been defeated. But I always argue that the Muslims have continued resisting, because when the Ottoman Caliphate collapsed, the Italians couldn't stay in Libya, they were kicked out. The French couldn't stay in Algeria, they were kicked out. The British couldn't stay in Egypt, they were kicked out. In other words, they couldn't capitalize on the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And when these people emerged from their victories, they looked at each other and said, how can we reunite the Ummah once more? Tunisia and Libya united for 24 hours in 1974. Egypt, Syria, and Iraq tried to unite for 6 months and then it eventually fell apart. I'm not saying that these attempts were wonderful. I'm saying that look at the intention of those who kicked out the colonizers. Their aim was never the nation state. They saw the nation state as the transition to re-establish the unified leadership. And that's why I argue that the problem with the debate when people have about unified leadership is they deride the past without appreciating who these people were who established the status quo. My grandfather fought in Algeria. He fought to kick out the French. My grandfather didn't fight for a nation state. He fought for the integrity and honor of the Ummah and believed that his efforts were the stepping stone to reunite the Ummah. And he believed that his generation was to establish the liberation required for us next generation to consider how to re-establish that unified leadership. It's a hard process. And that's why I think that when the Ummah talks about these issues, you know, with great pain and great difficulty, sometimes I believe, and I may be wrong in this, sometimes I believe that what the Ummah is complaining about more is not the inability to revive unified leadership. That's possible through struggle. What the Ummah dislikes is that it requires struggle to implement it. What the Ummah dislikes is it can't be done in comfort. What the Ummah dislikes is it doesn't like the idea that there has to be a real sacrifice in order to push through. The same way the Bosnians sacrificed, the same way the Turks have sacrificed, the same way the Uzbeks have sacrificed, the same way. That's what goes back to the Hadith. Because when you look at the Hadith of Prophet, when he talks about the idea of the Muslims will be many, but you'll be like the foam of the sea. Note the Hadith doesn't use the word weakness. The Prophet says that one day Allah will remove the fear in the hearts of your enemies and they will come about you as if at a feast. And the Sahaba, they're asking, will it be because we are weak or strong? They say, will we be many on that day or will we be few? Will we be strong or will we be weak? And Prophet ﷺ says, you will be many, but like the foam of the sea. He hasn't used the word weak yet, but look why he says we'll be like the foam of the sea. It's not because we're weak. It's not because we lack power. It's not because we lack the tools. It's not because we lack the means. He will say, it is because your hearts will be afflicted with wahan, a love of comfort, a love of the dunya, and a distaste, a dislike for death. Death here meaning you will dislike struggle, you will dislike sacrifice, meaning you will dislike the process necessary to manifest your power. You will dislike the process necessary to achieve the glory. You will want to achieve it through comfort, not through struggle. That's why when you're asking about Trump and Biden, when people said Trump will be worse, that's why I said the next 4 years are going to be years of struggle. Do you want to struggle through comfort or in dignity or in humiliation? What the American is really asking is, Trump is not going to come and knock on the door and hand it over to a white supremacist. Trump is not going to deploy the National Guard to commit a genocide of Americans. Trump is not going to do to the American citizen what Israel has done to the Palestinians. So when the American Muslim says that Trump is going to be worse for me, what do they mean when say Trump is going to be worse? I'm not defending Trump here. I'm saying it's true Trump might put the Muslim ban. Trump will cause a censorship on the campuses the way Biden is doing with regards to Israel and the like. But Trump won't do anything remotely similar to what Israel is doing to Palestine. Suggesting the real reason that Americans fear Trump or don't like the idea of punishing Biden because Trump might come is because they're aware there's a struggle coming and they believe there is more comfort in letting Biden win than to struggle through Trump. That's the point. The Ummah is not weak. The Ummah just has a dislike for struggle, or some parts of the Ummah, because the Bosnians are still struggling. And that's why I always tell people that if you want to connect with the Ummah, go to Bosnia, go and see them. Go and see how, despite 200, 300 years of attempts to erase Islam from the heart of Europe, it's still there with the minarets, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah. Go there, and I dare you to tell them that they're weak. And that's the point I want to say, is that people talk about the next 100 years. I think that when I look at the situation of the Ummah today, the colonizers failed to capitalize. They tried to maintain the colonization. They couldn't. Caliphate fell. Colonization was kicked out in 1950s, 1960s. And then we entered a debate. How do we establish unified Muslim leadership? There were attempts here and there. Oh, I see that people deride these organizations and say they are useless. But ask yourself why they were established. They weren't established for no reason. They were established with an intention in mind to help to reunify. I'm not saying that process is the right process. I'm saying don't talk as if there are attempts are not being made. Rather, go and identify how each community is struggling in its own regards, and then ask how you can unite those efforts. I spoke with, he won't mind me mentioning his name, Chris Abdurrahman from LaunchGood. He told me a very interesting statistic. He showed me a list and he said to me, the top five populations in the world. He said, number one is Muslims, 2 billion. Number two, China, 1.5 billion. Number three, India, 1 billion. Number four, US, 360 million. And he said, number five, English-speaking Muslims, 330 million. Largest population. It shows you why we were able to influence the narrative so much in the West. Now, those English-speaking populations are in America, Europe, Middle East, India, the Indian subcontinent, Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, these places. So across the whole world, you now have these English-speaking Muslims who are influencing Western rhetoric and who are influencing the narratives and who are making a difference with regards to Gaza or the like. Why? Because everybody is able to act in unison of it. And that's why I argue that if caliphate is the form, and the scholars have said that the substance of the people will create that form, I'm more focused on the substance of the people, not in terms of how people commonly use it, which is focus on your ibadah. Because when people say focus on your ibadah, they imply ibadah only means the salat and the tahajjud. Ibadah is every action of a Muslim that's done in the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If I do this podcast hoping to influence the narrative in America, this is ibadah. I believe I get hasanat for it. If I go and get on a plane and go to America, for example, to tell them, ya ibadallah, let's move. Every second I'm on the plane, I believe I get hasanat for it. Every second on the plane. I believe that the train getting on from Stonebridge Park Station to come to Bank Station, every second I'm getting hasanat. Why? The intention, inshallah, only Allah knows my heart, inshallah, every intention is for Allah. That's ibadah. We have twisted the meanings of what the Prophet ﷺ came in. When we talk about ibadah, people think about it in one way, but not the other way. And that's why I think that sometimes, and I finish on this particular point, when we're talking about the next 100 years, I believe that if the Ummah wants to restore its glory, go out and reconnect the limbs of the body of this Ummah that were ripped apart psychologically by the colonizers. Go out and connect the hand of Bosnia. Go out and reconnect the hand of Uzbekistan. Go out and reconnect the hand of Ghana, the arm of Ghana. Go out and reconnect Senegal. Go out and reconnect South Africa. Go out and reconnect Malaysia. Go out and reconnect Indonesia. Let those memories be poured into you until suddenly you see the Ummah for what it is, not what you think it is. That you see the Ummah for the strength it has, not for the weakness you think it has. That you go out and you see them, and then you will see opportunities that you did not think exist before. Why? You will see that you might be in America, but you can hold a conference in Istanbul and then bring those from Malaysia, and then you can go to Indonesia, and then you can go to Ghana, and you can bridge all these organizations together in a world of social media where we amplify each other's voices and stories and identities, and that creates an environment for new initiatives that allow us to manifest the Muslim power that you so desperately crave. But the point that I was saying is this, and this is the summary I want to put. Do not say the Ummah is weak. If you say it's weak, you are the one who is weak. And that's why Prophet ﷺ said that the one who says the Ummah is ruined, he is the one who is ruined, because the Ummah always has strength. The question is, if you believe yourself to be weak, go out and find that strength. And that's why I argued, and this is why we started the travel business in the first place. My wife used to say to me that when people ask you what books do you read, you spend 20% of the conversation on the books, 80% on the experiences you had in Bosnia, Ghana, Nigeria, these places as well. Why don't we do something where we can recreate those experiences where you connect? Because when you connect, you realize the Ummah is actually still magnificent. It's still beautiful. There's so much good in it. There's so much khair in it. And I always think that if you focus on those positive things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has delivered, Allah will be positive in your mind and deliver those positive results. And I think there's a difference between weakness and struggle. To struggle to feel that weight, and we feel it. You talk about Gaza, like you wake up, it's hard to sleep watching that genocide. I haven't felt good since that genocide has happened. It's hard, like, just to keep going until people keep moving, until people keep mobilizing. I tell them, not because I believe that they can stop the genocide, but because they're making a difference and they're making it complicated. I don't know what the outcome looks like, but I know we have to do something. I don't know what the outcome looks like, but I know we're making a difference. I don't know what the outcome looks like, but I know they're trying to shadow ban accounts because they're frustrated about something. I don't know what the outcome looks like, but I know they're spending millions on narratives on social media that we, because they're worried that their monopoly on the narrative has been broken by us for free. I know that Biden is worried in the election because of the Muslim vote. I know that Starmer is worried about the election because of Gaza and the impact of the Muslims. I know that they're worried about it. I don't know what the outcome will look like, but I know that given they're worried about it, it means there's a power there that we have that we need to appreciate and therefore mobilize and use it and capitalize on it. That's what I'm telling people. Use the powers that you have and leave the outcome to Allah. You ask me, what do the next 100 years look like? I don't know, but I can tell you that a people of substance, a people who stand for justice, a people who strive, a people who move, a people who mobilize, a people who choose not to sit at home and but rather to go out, a people who say, listen, I'm ready to struggle, I'm ready to strive, I'm ready to feel that pressure, I'm ready to take risks in this. Though a people like that will create a system far greater than any system that you read in the past, because Allah has promised it. Allah says that فَأُولَٰئِكَ كَانَ سَعْيُهُمْ مَشْكُورًا. Allah rewards the striving of those who achieve. And that's why I argue that at the end of the day, and I always say it, I say, ya ibadallah, at the end of the day, it's about your perspective or what your goal is in this dunya. You ask about the next 100 years. I don't know if I want to see the next 100 years. Not because I think it will be bleak, but because for me, it's irrelevant about what happens in the next 100 years. The question I ask myself is, what can I do now within the powers that Allah has given? But for what reason? Not because of a reason in this dunya. This dunya belongs to Allah. Allah will decide what He wants to do with it. Allah decided to destroy Hud's people, but decided to reward Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's people. Allah decided to destroy Lot's people, but decided to guide Yunus Alayhi Wasallam's people, even though Yunus left them and abandoned them and went into the whale, and he came back, he found his people guided. Allah is going to do with his dunya what he decides to do. I'm not asking the question of what I think Allah should do with his dunya. I'm asking the question, Allah has already decided the outcome. Where can I position myself as a vehicle? Allah gave me a voice to use something, I will use that voice. Ya Allah, what else can I do? If I have finances, let me use the finances. If I can liaise with somebody, go and liaise with somebody. Can I take people out to go rediscover the memories of the Ummah? Yalla, take people to record. What else can I do? What else can I do? Why? Because on the day of judgment, I will not be asked about the next 100 years. I will be told, Allah gave you the ability to speak. What did you say? Allah gave you the ability to spend. What did you spend on? Allah gave you the ability to think. What did you do with it? Allah gave you this power to do this. What did you do with it? Allah gave you the ability to make change, even on the small level, because Allah said, وَمَن يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَهُ. Those who do even an atom of good deed, Allah sees it. Allah will say, show me the atoms of deeds that you did based on the powers that you have, because I know, inshallah, if we ever enter Jannah al-Firdaus, we're hardly likely to ask about this dunya, but rather we will celebrate that no matter how bleak the situation looked, we moved. No matter how bleak the situation looked, we mobilized. No matter how bleak or how powerful the system looked, we still challenged it. No matter when people told us there's no point, we kept going. No matter how many people said there's despair, there's no hope, we were heartbroken, but we kept moving. That ummah that does that is an ummah that will achieve extraordinary things, even if it doesn't appreciate it. Because when I read the seerah of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam, the Prophet went through persecution for the first 13 years of his life, in the first 13 years of the da'wah. Victory in Badr, defeat in Uhud, existential crisis in Khandaq, Treaty of Hudaybiyah that Umar al-Khattab believed to be a humiliation. And then the next year he was given Fatah Mecca. But even Fatah Mecca, he didn't see Quds liberated, but he went back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that was sufficient for him to go down as the greatest man to have lived in history. Why? Because he's not measured only by his material gains. He's measured by the spirit that he gave and imbued within this ummah that says never give up and keep moving. It's the spirit that meant France colonized Algeria 132 years and still after 132 years when the Algerians liberated, they didn't chant, "We kicked out the French, congratulate the Algerian state." They said, "Ya Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Ya Muhammad mabruk alik, oh Prophet Muhammad, congratulations, 132 years of struggle and we returned Algeria to you." That's the spirit of the heart that never dies. That's the spirit that keeps the ummah alive. That's the spirit that allows the ummah to achieve glory. So for me, I don't measure the 100 years by outcome. I measure it by the spirit of the ummah. Is this ummah going to maintain this spirit of moving, of mobilizing, of getting back up after every mistake and changing? Or is it an ummah that's going to just wait for something to happen because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one in charge of the outcome? And I believe, I don't know what will happen in Gaza. I don't know what would happen in the next 100 years, but I am proud of an ummah that moved. I'm proud of an ummah that changed the narrative on Gaza. I'm proud of an ummah that has Biden worrying about his election chances. I'm proud of an ummah that has made Keir Starmer worrying about his chances as well. I'm proud of an ummah that keeps talking even though they are heartbroken. I'm proud of an ummah that keeps mobilizing even though their heart might be filled with despair. I'm proud of an ummah that is beginning to see its power. I'm proud of an ummah that Netanyahu is spending millions on to try to silence. I'm proud of an ummah that made Blinken change his travel plans to go to leaders in order to try. I'm proud of an ummah in Pakistan where, despite the machinations of an establishment in order to try to maintain its power and to rig elections, still they managed to deliver independent candidates and break the rigging of the establishment and send the whole Pakistan in turmoil. I'm proud that the ummah is still alive. Never talk about the ummah like it's dead. Don't talk about the ummah like it's weak. We're going through a turbulent process. We're going through a struggle. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in control of everything. Our choice or our decision is not about what the outcome should be. Our decision is about what powers do we have and how can we use those powers, however minuscule they might be. For wallahi, the first of a rain is always a droplet. That drop is what leads to that rain that gives life to the land after it's appeared arid and have nothing on it. It's that first drop of rain that we're looking for. And as long as we keep moving, in my opinion, there's always something to be optimistic for in this ummah. Optimistic in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not necessarily in the outcome. Optimistic that Allah is in control, acknowledging Allah is in control, and acknowledging that at the end of the day, the ultimate goal is that when our soul leaves our body, we have something with which to look at the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, say, "Ya Rasulullah, I left the dunya in a dire state, but Ya Rasulullah, I was not one of those people who sat at home and did nothing. And certainly I was not one of those people who used to look at Jalal mobilizing and thinking Muslim and tell him, what's the point of these efforts that you're doing? I was not one of those, Ya Rasulullah. I was one of those who kept moving, mobilizing and telling people, go, go, go. They told me the whole world is against you and the system is against you. But I told them, if the whole system is against me, Allah is sufficient for me. And I mobilize against that. And Ya Rasulullah, here I am with the greatest victory in Firdaus, sitting next to you. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. With the Sahaba as my neighbors, alhamdulillah. With Muhammad Jalil, inshallah, next to me, inshallah, bi-idhnillahi ta'ala. And this is the greatest victory. And that's why the Muslim is always an optimist. This is where I finish. That's why the Muslim is always an optimist. Because even in the darkest moments, the Muslim believes change is always possible because change is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Don't ask yourself what the outcome should be. Ask yourself what you can do to be the vehicle to achieve that outcome. And you will find that the opportunity you can't see is just around the corner because Allah monopolized the outcome for himself. All he asks from us is move and Allah will deliver the outcome. May the ummah keep moving, inshallah.
Ameen. Sami Hamdi. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time.
Jazakallah.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels. And head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.